All set for your flight?
Yep, I've got everything I need. Eye mask, neck pillow, T-Mobile, headphones.
Wait, T-Mobile?
You bet. Free in-flight Wi-Fi, 15% off all Hilton brands. I never go anywhere without T-Mobile. Same goes for my water bottle, chewing gum, nail clippers,
okay,
passport.
I'm gonna leave you to it.
Find out how you can experience travel better at T-Mobile.com/travel.
Qualifying plan required. Wi-Fi were available on select U.S. airlines. Deposit and Hilton Honors membership required for 15% discount. Terms and conditions apply.
The people at KPMG make the difference for their clients. Talented teams leveraging the right technology to uncover insights that illuminate opportunity. KPMG teams together with their clients, working shoulder to shoulder with them to help grow and transform their enterprise. Are you ready to make the difference together? Go to visit.kpmg.us/transformation to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Battleground Ukraine with me, Saul David, and Patrick Bishop. The big news this week is that Ukraine continues to make important gains on the battlefield, particularly south of Bakhmut and in western Zaporizhia, and also to degrade Russia's defensive capability in Crimea as part of a wider strategy to wrest back control of the northern Black Sea. Away from the battlefield, President Joe Biden doubled down on his support for Ukraine by telling a meeting of the United Nations General Assembly that no nation can be secure if, and I quote, we allow Ukraine to be carved up.
And in Russia, opposition figures are spreading reports that Vladimir Putin's staunch ally, Ramzan Kadyrov, the brutal Chechen, has either died in hospital or is seriously ill. Meanwhile, imprisoned Russian ultra-nationalist Igor Girkin has predicted the collapse of Putin's regime and compared the inevitable domestic unrest to the troubles in 17th century Russia that preceded the rise of the Romanov dynasty. Slightly less encouraging news for Ukraine is that, according to RUSI, the London-based think tank, a pro-Russia party is set to win the upcoming election in Slovakia, which is a member of the EU, where there are said to be more than 250 disinformation peddling and largely pro-Moscow media outlets, as well as up to 2,000 Facebook pages pushing the same line. Well, we'll discuss the possible ramifications of all this. But first, the battlefield news. So what can you tell us?
Well, the big news is that Ukraine has liberated two key settlements south of Bakhmut, and that is Klishivka and Andriivka, that may, in the opinion of the Institute for the Study of War, have degraded the Russian defense in that area and rendered as many as three Russian brigades combat ineffective. Ukrainian Ground Forces commander, General Sersky, noted that the settlements were keystones of the Russian Bakhmut-Horlivka defensive line, which had now been breached. One of his spokesmen added that the Ukrainian army's liberation of Klishivka gave it fire control over Russian ground lines of communication supplying Russian forces in the Bakhmut area. The implication of all of this is that these forces will, as the ISW puts it, struggle to replenish their combat strength and defend against any further Ukrainian offensive activities south of Bakhmut. But Ukraine is also advancing in the vital western Zaporizhia Oblast near Robotynye, with the road and rail hub of Tokmak as its immediate objective. They have, for example, made inroads into the settlement of Verbove, widening their original breach along a 2.6-kilometer section of the Russian defensive positions. Ukrainian officials have suggested that the series of Russian lines currently ahead of the Ukrainian advance may be less challenging because Russian forces had concentrated the majority of their combat power at the forward positions which have already been breached. These Russian forces, needless to say, have suffered heavy losses. Now, the Ukrainian successes have prompted the Russians in turn to move the so-called elite troops of the 83rd Separate Guards Air Assault Brigade from the Bakhmut area to this sector, which may in turn have played its part in the fall of Klishivka, which the 83rd had been defending. So you really need to see the battlefield as one continuous whole. And if the Ukrainians are pushing in one area or fixing the Russians in one area, it's making them more vulnerable somewhere else. Well, we mentioned last week, Patrick, that the Ukrainian strategy of targeting Russian ground and naval forces in the Crimea and the Black Sea was beginning to yield results. Well, we've seen more of that, haven't we?
Yes, we have. But before that, I'd just like to say two things. Well, one is you're absolutely right to describe the 83rd Guards Air Assault Brigade as a so-called elite unit. The Russian airborne forces have been very hard hit in this war, and I don't believe that the replacement troops can properly be described as elite, as they'll have had nothing like the training needed to get them up to what the West would regard as an elite force. The fact they're being used to shore up the frontline defenses can only mean that the Russians are in trouble here. Second, I just want to reference a video that we were alerted to by a listener, Carl Larson, which shows very starkly the reality of the front lines around Bakhmut. This is from the Ukrainian perspective. Carl served with the International Legion of Ukraine Volunteer Force, and the action was shot on a helmet-mounted GoPro by one of the fighters a few weeks back, and it tracks an incident when a small squad of legionnaires mounted in a vehicle run over a Russian mine. Now, you really ought to look at it. It's quite extraordinary as the action is then intercut with a view from a Russian drone. I can't read out the whole line here, but if you search Mad Dog Team or Team Kilo hitting mine near Bakhmut on YouTube, it will come up. It makes for very dramatic and rather disturbing viewing. Anyway, thanks for that, Carl. Well, back to the Black Sea. According to the news outlet Ukrainska Pravda, which got close links with the Ukrainian Security Service, the Ukrainian Security Service, the SBU, and the Ukrainian Navy conducted a unique special operation that destroyed a Russian S-400 Triumph air defense system near Yevpatoria in Crimea on the 14th of September. Now, these, of course, are very, very important. These are sort of anti-missile missiles, so they're crucial to the air defenses of Crimea. Now, what happened was that they fired off a load of drones, 11 drones. All of them were shot down, but that was really to degrade the Russian air defenses, opening the way for the firing of two Neptune anti-ship missiles. Now, these destroyed this S-400 battery, and they cost an enormous amount of money. This is $625 million worth of kit. And of course, it's the second strike on an S-400 in recent weeks. The last one, you remember, we were talking about last week, was carried out by a Storm Shadow, British supplied Storm Shadow cruise missile. So this leaves the Crimea, more specifically the Black Sea fleet, hugely exposed. Now, on the same day, there were some successful naval drone strikes against two Russian patrol ships actually at sea in the southwestern quarter of the Black Sea. Corvette was very damaged, and this was near the entrance to Sevastopol Bay. I think we've decided to revert to Sevastopol, haven't we? So we'll be talking about that later. We've had a response about our pronunciation, which is quite amusing. Anyway, so all this will actually help the Ukrainians greatly on the grain export front, which is already improving, actually. There have been a number of sailings through the Black Sea maritime corridor in recent weeks. Now, just a quick further reference to what's coming out of Russia. Bad news in terms of state propaganda terms. There's a former deputy commander of the Southern Military District, a Lieutenant General Andrei Gurulev, who is also a deputy in the Duma. Now, he's quite been voluble in the past, I believe, but he's published a telegram message that condemned lying in the Russian military communiques, and also lamenting the damage that Ukrainian air defenses are inflicting on Russian helicopters, along with a lot of that other stuff. So what do you make of Gurulev's comments?
Well, they're odd, really, aren't they? It's more of the same to a certain extent. I mean, Gorulev, after all, was the man who leaked the audio message from Major General Ivan Popov, the former commander of the 58th Combined Arms Army, who was sacked after complaining about a lack of support for his troops. Now, Popov apparently was very popular, so this didn't go down very well with his men, and they are the troops who are defending chiefly in the western Zaporizhia area, this crucial battlefield area. But the point about more effective Ukrainian air defenses negating Russian attack helicopters is significant, I think, Patrick, because, of course, those attack helicopters were being used against the armor that was used at the start of the counteroffensive, where we go back a month or so ago. And this significance, i.e. the fact that they can't use the attack helicopters in quite the same way, but might become even more relevant if Ukrainian commanders decide to deploy their armored reserves, including, of course, Abrams tanks, which apparently they're just getting delivery of now, after they've broken through the main Russian defensive lines. And that, of course, could be imminent. Now, in other matters, President Joe Biden has signaled that America's support for Ukraine was unwavering with a speech at the United Nations General Assembly in New York. He said that no nation can be secure if, and I quote, we allow Ukraine to be carved up. And of course, all of this is an attempt to rally international support for Kyiv's effort to repel Russian aggression, as we know. His rhetoric, though, wasn't just for an international audience. It was also partly directed towards an American audience, where a wing of the Republican Party, we've mentioned this many times, is threatening to reduce US aid for Ukraine. Now, here's an interesting point. Biden's administration has asked Congress to green light an additional $24 billion in security and humanitarian aid to Ukraine. But the Republicans who control the House have all but ignored that request as lawmakers scramble to ensure government funding continues beyond September. And this point, actually, interesting enough, Patrick, I saw in a separate article, is really important because when we talk about the delay of all these various weapons systems to Ukraine from America, there's this kind of assumption, well, you know, it was to do with escalation and it was to do with, you know, making sure they had enough kit in their own arsenals. Actually, apparently, this Republican control of Congress is really vital to understanding why there's been this drip feed of this equipment. Biden, by the way, at that same address, was also keen to downplay the danger of war with China by saying that Beijing and Washington needed to cooperate on climate and that the partnerships that America was fostering around the globe, from Asia to the Indo-Pacific, were not about containing any country. And that, of course, is a clear reference to Beijing. Okay, back to Russia. What, Patrick, have you heard about our old friend Ramzan Kadyrov?
Well, the rumours, there are always rumours, aren't there, where he is concerned. He's run Chechnya for the Kremlin, essentially, for the last 15 years. Well, the news is he might have joined his fellow psychopath, Yevgeny Prigozhin, in Valhalla or Hades or wherever these guys go. The whole rumour mill started turning last Friday when a Chechen opposition channel wrote that Kadyrov was in a coma. There have also been stories he's actually dead. But the rumors got quite a lot of oxygen from the Ukrainian military intelligence, who seem to be very much stirring the mud, shall we put it, whenever they can on these occasions. And they jumped in and said, yes, indeed, Kadyrov was in a critical condition. Well, that prompted media counterattack from Kadyrov's camp. They posted two videos of him walking in the rain. Looked a bit puffy in the face and a bit sort of breathless, but he came back saying, I strongly recommend that everyone who cannot distinguish the truth from lies on the internet go for a walk, get some fresh air, and put their thoughts in order. Now, it was no evidence that this was actually taken on the day it was, or near the day that it was posted. So it doesn't really clear matters up. But if he is a goner, then it's obviously very bad news for Putin because, you know, he's been a staunch supporter. Okay, he's made a few critical noises, but as always with these sort of people who pipe up in this way, it's about how the war isn't being prosecuted properly, not that the war is a bad thing per se. But if he does go, then Chechnya is a very unstable place. There's all sorts of people who'll be jostling around, vying to take over from him, including some Wahhabi element, that's to say, you know, militant extreme Islamist groups. So the last thing I would have thought Putin wants is an Islamic militant threat on the border of Russia proper. So, yeah, I mean, I would have thought that if he is dead, it's extremely bad news. Also, we mentioned this a bit earlier, this sort of criticism coming from internal people you'd imagine were supporters, and Igor Girkin, who has been a bit of a maverick all along the line, he's now in jail, but his lawyer put out a statement from him saying that the Kremlin's basically in deep doo-doo. The what he calls the bureaucratic oligarchic system is on the point of collapse. It was his duty, Girkin said, to actually point this out to other patriots like himself and to start seeking around for a suitable alternative. Well, I would have thought this was pretty dangerous talk from Girkin. He's in a jail. He's completely vulnerable to whatever Putin wants to do to him. But once again, a sign that, you know, that the real threat to the Putin regime is coming from the ultra-nationalists at this point, not from any sort of, you know, liberal democratic reformists.
Yeah, and the other important bit of news away from the battlefield, Patrick, slightly alarming this as far as the Ukrainian camp is concerned, is that in Slovakia, there's a possibility that some pro-Russian elements may actually take power. Now, if you go back to Russia's full-scale invasion in February 2022, Slovakia was fully committed to defending Ukraine's sovereignty. And per capita, it has been since then one of Kyiv's staunchest supporters and was one of the first NATO countries to deliver fighter jets. Now, you know, just to stress the point, it's not only a member of the EU, it's also a member of NATO. But if the polls are correct, the likely winner of the country's general election on the 30th of September is Robert Fico, a man who praises Moscow and models himself on Viktor Orban, the far-right authoritarian leader of neighboring Hungary, another maverick from within the EU. Now, how is this about turn possible? Well, according to the Bratislava-based think tank Globsec, which monitors former communist states, an incredible 50% of Slovaks consider the US rather than Russia to be a security risk, while only 40% of them actually blame Russia for the war. So you've really got to split down the middle in Slovakian society. Almost three quarters, and so maybe it's not such a big split, consider Russia their brother nation and are bought into the idea of a Slav brotherhood. Current president Zuzana Kaputova, an environmental activist and lawyer who was really representative of the pro-Western faction within Slovakia, blames a pro-Russian information storm for this assault on good government. Now, if you're an optimist, you might think that elections campaigns in Slovakia often produce dramatic last-minute swings, so that could happen. And even if Fico does win, he might be persuaded by other members of the EU to moderate his pro-Russian position. But of course, the opposite could also be the case.
Okay, before we take the break, I just want to mention some news that was around at the beginning of the week that President Zelensky has fired all six of his deputy defense ministers. No real explanation was given. Among them, of course, was Hanna Maliar, who we often quoted on the pod, but presumably we won't be hearing from her anymore. Now, this, of course, is just after the sacking, 2 weeks after the sacking of the longtime defense minister, Alexei Reznikov, over ongoing corruption allegations at the ministry. Now, concerns are pretty widespread, aren't they, about corruption? And this sort of stuff just really feeds that narrative, doesn't it, Saul?
Yeah, I mean, again, Patrick, you can see this in two ways. Of course, we should have mentioned that Zelensky has also just spoken at the United Nations General Assembly. And it may have been that before his trip to America, where, of course, he's trying to shore up international support for Ukraine, he was sending out another signal that he's prepared to clear the Orgean stables in Ukraine of anyone who is not pulling their weight as far as the war effort's concerned. Now, there's no direct connection between these sackings and corruption, but you can make up your own mind about this. As I've said many times, Patrick, it's the willingness of Zelensky and others to take these hard decisions that is in many ways quite impressive. And we should also make the distinction between the Ministry of Defense, which is really about procurement and supply, and battlefield performance. You'll have noticed, Patrick, that none of the senior commanders since the start of this war have been sacked. Complete opposite, of course, is the case in the Russian military. So that tells you, generally speaking, that Zelensky and the Ukrainians generally are pretty pleased with the performance of their commanders, not so much those bureaucrats who are supplying the army.
Yeah, I think this is also a message to his own people, isn't it? I mean, this is part of who Zelensky is. We shouldn't forget how he came to power. He came to power via a TV comedy show, which you can see in the West, Servant of the People. Actually, it's pretty funny, in which he plays a history teacher who's filmed by one of his students ranting about government corruption. and it's uploaded, it goes viral, and the teacher ends up president. So this is really at the heart of Zelensky's identity and his political message. And yes, he has to signal to the US that their money is not being wasted, but he's also has to tell his people that he's still who he says he is. Anyway, that's enough for this half. We're going to take a break. Do join us in part two when, as ever, we'll be answering listeners' questions. Welcome back. Well, the first question is from Masayuki Iwasa from Japan. And Masayuki says, since my name is too complicated to say, just call me MK. Well, I think I've given it a pretty good shot there. I hope you do too. Anyway, really what's the question is here is, why is the war slipping down the news agenda? The Masayuki says, when the conflict started, it was a hit here in Japan, i.e. as a news item. And now I see more ramen commercials than I do coverage of the war. So what do you guys think? Does the war need to be known more to the world, or is a news item or two here or there enough? I'd love to hear your opinions. What do you think, Saul?
Well, I'm just glad you did the pronunciation, Patrick, although Masayuki did actually say he was perfectly happy for us to butcher his name. And by us, I think he means me. This message from Masayuki is exactly the reason we're doing the podcast, because, of course, it is inevitable that in a lot of Western countries, and I include Japan in that, there is going to be a certain amount of war weariness where it is going to slip off the news agenda. And I can't tell you how many people contact us and say thank you for keeping, you know, us constantly up to date with what's going on, because our normal press outlets aren't doing the same thing. So it's a real shame, though, I have to say, Patrick, although the only mitigation, I suppose, as far as the Japanese are concerned, is that they're much more concerned with what's happening in the South China Sea and China and Taiwan than they are with Russia. But of course, in our view, everyone should be concerned with what's happening in Ukraine.
Well, this seems to be the theme of the week is pronunciation, because we've got one here from Slavek. I think I've got that right. It's S-L-A-W-E-K. I think Slavek would be as it should be said. We remember talking last week about you say Sevastopol, I say Sevastopol. He said, I want to drop you a line to say that the English version from years ago was pronounced with a B. And the reason for this, that the Russian alphabet, which is not derived from Latin, in the Russian alphabet, the letter B is pronounced as V. So somehow, somewhere, folks speaking English as their first language ended up translating. Then he's got the Cyrillic for the Black Sea port to Sebastopol. He says, I know this because I'm of the generation when school children in Poland had little choice but to learn Russian at school, as the subject was mandatory. Yeah, we've almost forgotten that now. Now, I'm just going to add something here from Askold, our dear friend Askold Kuchelnitsky, who says, I know that you and Saul try hard to get pronunciation correct. If you're unsure about pronunciation, you can call me anytime to check. Well, thanks for Askold. So he says, he gives us a couple of tips straight away. There's one that you got wrong earlier, Saul. He says, for Ukrainian and Russian, E-I-V-A-N-S, the I in Ivan is pronounced as E, as in Iba Gumlad, which our non-British listeners is a joke about Yorkshire people. They're meant to always say Iba Gum. Anyway, so it's Ivan, not Ivan, as you said earlier, Saul, which is how the Welsh preparatively pronounce it. He goes on to say that the M-A-I in Maidan, i.e. the square in Kiev, where we were the other day, is pronounced just like that, my. Not, he says, like a distraught, alluring maiden waiting to be rescued by a knight of the round table. And then he confirms, yes, it's Sevastopol, not Sebastopol. And he blames early translations of War and Peace for this. Anyway, but we've got a bit of a problem, you know, with these pronunciations. You don't want to get too overboard, do you? I mean, I heard someone pronouncing it the other day as Sevastopol, which sounds to me more authentic, but we're not going to start using that, are we? So I think there's a sort of happy medium where you make it as authentic as you can without baffling the listeners.
Yeah, this may be a bad analogy, Patrick, but it reminds me of the days when I was writing historical fiction, and there came the question with whether or not you were going to actually try and write phonetically someone's accent. So it could have been someone from the East End of London, it could have been a Cockney, but it could, of course, have been lots of different nationalities. And actually, the best advice that was given to me by my editor editor was, don't even go there. It'll look like a complete, you know, mishmash. You'll butcher everything, just write in plain English and describe the fact that this is in an Irish accent and let people make up their own minds. And that was the sensible way to do it, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Or should I say plus, because there's another little addition from Askell that says that apparently the Ukrainian military, in military speak, on a battlefield, instead of saying Roger or affirmative, you say plus, pronounced that way, plus, P-L-U-S. So there, I sound a bit like Alan Partridge here. I better stop there.
Good stuff. Okay, we've got a good question here from Joachim Zander, who I suspect is probably Dutch, although he doesn't say one way or another. But anyway, Joachim asked the question, is there any knowledge about if the Russians are building more defensive lines in those areas where the Ukrainians broke through the first one or two lines of the three that we always hear about? I personally cannot imagine that they wouldn't be doing that, building new lines, knowing for weeks and weeks the respective locations where their enemy, the Ukrainians, were pushing forward strongly. Well, we do have a bit of information about this, Joachim, actually, because Tokmak, which we keep referencing, this absolutely vital road and rail hub, if the Ukrainians can get to it, just to repeat the point, they will have fire control over Melitopol and that main route of supply, east-west supply, the so-called land bridge. Well, Tokmak, we now know, and this is coming from Ukrainian intelligence and other sources, the Russians are scrabbling around to build defenses. They're trying to build tank traps. They're trying to build trenches. But the reality is that they're doing this hurriedly because of the success of the Ukrainians. And there is no possibility that they're going to be able to build the sort of defensive positions that are anything like as comparable to what the Ukrainians have already managed to break through. So they are scrabbling around. Of course, they're bound to be doing that. And it'll just emphasize two things, really. The importance of Tokmak, but also the panic that these Ukrainian successes have already produced in the Russian army.
Got a question here from Nick. And I'd be interested to hear your historical take on this from the 19th century, Saul. And Nick asks, how does Ukraine take back Crimea? He said he's watched the way they've taken down the S-400 air defenses, mounted those raids on the oil platforms, et cetera, et cetera. But he says, you know, how easy is this going to be? He's recently been reading about the difficulties the German army had in World War II taking Crimea from the Soviets. He said it was an eight-month-long campaign and some of the bloodiest battles of the war. Well, you're quite right about that, Nick. The siege of Sevastopol, or the operation to take Sevastopol, took 8 months and 4 days. That was from October the 41 to July 42, and this was actually when the Red Army was on the back foot. It was very, very weak, but they still managed to launch an amphibious landing at Kerch, which relieved the pressure. That went off in the mid-winter, the depths of winter. It really must have been quite a thing in December 41. It took the Germans all the way until June 42 before they were in a position to properly besiege the place. And it began with Sevastopol, that is. And it began with a huge air operation, which was absolutely vast. It outdid the Luftwaffe's bombing campaigns on Warsaw, Rotterdam, London, etc. And by the time they'd finished, only 11 buildings were left undamaged. So I think the point here is that it's a huge, huge problem, military problem, taking the Crimea proper. What does your knowledge of the Crimean War tell you, Saul?
Yeah, and the other historical parallel, Patrick, is going back to the Crimean War in the 19th century, 1854 to 1856. Well, the siege of Sevastopol was really from the end of 1854 to the summer of 1855, when the French, it was, not the British, it was, of course, an Anglo-French expeditionary force supported by the Sardinians and also the Turks, but the main striking power was British and French. And it was actually the French who made the final breakthrough into Sevastopol with their storm troops in the summer of 1855. But, you know, the overall point here is it was an incredibly difficult nut to crack. So the question from Nick is it going to be the same again? Well, I don't think so, Nick. And the big difference between now and then is that the Ukrainians are seeing the much bigger picture. They are, of course, a neighboring power, whereas back in the 19th century, the French and the British had actually landed an amphibious landing, very difficult to do, on the Crimean Peninsula. Well, the Ukrainians are in a much better strategic position. What they're really going to do with Crimea is not retake it by force. They're going to isolate it. They're going to sever the Kerch Bridge, and they're going to make sure that no supplies can come in from the other way by severing the land bridge from Russia to Crimea. And as a result, they're going to force the Russians to surrender. So it's not going to be a bloodbath. It's going to be a strategic isolation of Crimea, which will put them in a very strong position. So I'm not envisaging another siege of Sevastopol because I don't think it needs to come to that.
Well, the next one I'm not going to attempt to answer because I think John Bell, who's sent this in, has pretty much provided the answer himself. Now, he says, thank you for the excellent podcast. My only issue is I wish the episodes were more frequent and or longer. Not sure about that. So here we go. Anyway, he says, I've got a question about mine clearance in frozen ground. Having broken a spade trying to dig up leaks from frozen ground here in Sussex last winter, I wonder how viable it is to clear mines in the depths of winter. Iced ground can be extraordinarily hard and difficult to penetrate. The course of the war suggests the Ukrainians will be needing to pass through minefields for a long time to come. Do you think this will still be possible once winter sets in? Well, I don't know. But all I would say conversely is it makes it equally difficult. I would have thought to plant any more mines. So that I would have thought the kind of military situation is kind of literally and metaphorically frozen. Got any thoughts on that, Saul?
Yeah, we'll go back to the Tokmak question we've just dealt with. And the reality is that the Ukrainians are almost through the main belts, the thickest belts of minefields. So it's a question of them planting new ones now. And you know, as you say, Patrick, the same argument is going to work both ways. Well, yes, they could do it in the next few weeks, but they simply don't have time. And what's interesting about the fluidity of the battlefield or the possible fluidity of the battlefield is that there is a distance between the Russians are defending now and where they are going to try and defend in Tokmak. And you can't lace the whole area with mines. So you've now got to decide where your new main line of resistance is. Is it going to be close to Tokmak? And if it is, you know, you've got all the security issues of how you're going to get through those new defenses to support the troops further afield. So it's not a simple equation either way.
And it's by no means the actual laying of the mines. It makes you extremely vulnerable. You're going to be identified pretty well immediately by surveillance drones, I would have thought, and then you're vulnerable to artillery fire. So I wouldn't want to be going out and planting mines anywhere near the front line if I was a Russian. Interesting point here from Dave Anderson, who says, apart from the political and morale benefits of liberating a town, what are the military operational benefits? Is it somewhere to live, eat? Is it easier to defend? Is it a good launch pad for other operations? Does that all apply to the small demolished villages too? Well, I'll just make a few quick points, Saul. I think there is obviously a morale and political benefit. There's a big symbolic importance attached to Bakhmut, for example. And there is a bit of a sort of military benefit. I mean, you'll be living in a wasteland, but you will actually have roads getting you your supplies in and out. The ruins will provide you with a large amount of cover, and there are also good defensive positions against a counterattack. So yeah, even though you are inheriting in this case, if you've seen the images of any of these liberated towns and villages, I mean, they are moonscapes. There's not barely a roof on a building, but like I say, there still are some sort of tactical benefits. What do you think, Sean?
Yeah, I mean, the real key point about towns, and we're getting into urban warfare chat here now, Patrick, is that their chief benefit is to the defender rather than the attacker. The attacker wants to take them, but only to deprive the defender of that ability to, you know, to stop you moving forward. So Stalingrad ultimately becomes such a difficult place to take, and Bakhmut for that matter, because once the buildings get reduced it turns into, as you say, this moonscape, it's much easier to defend than it is actually to attack. So somewhere like Robertinye, for example, is a great defensive position. And once you've taken it, you've basically managed to infiltrate into the strong defensive position of the enemy. So you've got to sort of see it almost in negative terms. It's not of massive value to the attacker per se, apart from the fact that you've actually obviously created a, you know, quite a sizable wedge into the opposition's defense. And this is particularly relevant in what's happening in Western Zaporizhia, because those towns that you can see that are falling slowly but surely, or those settlements, were keystones to the Russian defensive position. Okay, we've got a question here from Gretchen, and she asks, how is it that a country with a GDP smaller than Italy, and of course she means Russia, is able to prosecute an expensive war and also at a time when it's under sanctions? How long can this realistically go on? It just seems, says Gretchen, like there must be a lot of strain in Russia that we don't see or hear about. Patrick, what do you think?
It is one of the mysteries of this war, isn't it, Saul? At the outset, a lot of optimistic noises were made about the effect sanctions were going to have on Russia's ability to maintain its war effort. But here we are, you know, all this time later, and it still seems to be going strong. On the political front, there don't seem to be any real impacts on the standard of living of ordinary Russians, etc. Certainly not to the point where you're going to get to 1917 when people come out in the streets, because basically the war is making their lives unbearable. Now, I'm no economist, but it's very strange, and I haven't read anything that actually provides an answer. You're absolutely right. Russia's economic performance is certainly not commensurate with its claims to be a world superpower. It's number 11th. Its GDP is 11th in the world listings, which puts it, you know, just ahead of Brazil, I think. Now, the main contributor to the economy, actually, to the GDP, should I say, is service. Now, service is a very broad sector, but it really is what it sounds like. It's people doing things for other people. 57% of GDP comes from that. So it's all internally generated GDP, if you like. It employs astonishing 2/3 of the population are actually in the service sector. But the thing that actually makes them their money is oil and gas. Now, provides 17% of GDP. And I think that's where perhaps the keys to the whole thing, that's where these oil exports, which seem to have been able to oil and gas exports, energy exports, we seem to have been able to circumvent sanctions very successfully with customers in what we used to call the third world, China, India, Africa, et cetera. I mean, they keep the cash flowing, and that's very, very essential to keeping the population happy. So I think that there is quite a lot of sort of fat still left there. And certainly in terms of a political effect, sanctions still really haven't come into play. But having said all that, you know, there is no growth in Russia. There's minus growth in Russia. It's down minus 6% this year. So in time, hopefully it won't come to that, but in time, if the war does continue for a considerable period to come, then inevitably it must do something to dramatically reduce their ability to wage war. Okay, I've got one here, a bit of a blast from the past, which is from Richard Appleby, who says, I'm interested in the medical support to the Ukrainian military. There's hardly any reporting on this. Presumably the government's PR people think it's too risky. Now, he says recent conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan saw massive advances in military medical abilities. And I wonder if this progress has been continued with this conventional war. He's asking, how do they casuvac without air superiority? How are military casualties integrated into the civilian system? Now, I think we're not really in a position to answer that today, but it's something we're certainly going to be looking at. It is a fascinating part of the war. But I just have to say, I too know Dr. Appleby. We first met in Afghanistan in 2008 when he was an army doctor, and we met again about 7 or 8 years later, when I was having a rather embarrassing operation done on my rear end in the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital. I was lying face down on the operating table when the doctor asked me whether I was the same Patrick Bishop who'd been in forward operating base Inkerman, that'll ring a bell for you, Saul, 10 miles up the Helmand River from Sangin in southern Afghanistan in the summer of 2008. So I replied that indeed it was. And so while Richard got on with his work, we had a fascinating conversation about our time in FOB Inkerman, which the nurses found hilarious. So I should say I was only there a few days and Richard was there for a hell of a long time, but it was a pretty grim place to be. Well, good to hear from you again, Richard. As I say, this is something we'll be looking at, so stay tuned.
Yeah, and just an added bit of detail on that, Patrick. I mean, I read a statistic a couple of days ago. I mean, and we should mention that Zelensky, when just before he spoke in New York to the United Nations General Assembly, went to see a lot of victims from the Ukrainian war, that is Ukrainian servicemen who are being treated for their injuries in America. And a lot of them are limbless. And apparently something like 50,000 Ukrainian soldiers have lost one or more limbs, which tells you two things, of course. One, that the casualties have been very heavy, but two, that an awful lot of people are surviving the type of wounds that would have killed people in earlier conflicts. And that, without question, is partly down to these improved medical protocols that were honed during Afghanistan and Iraq.
That's a really interesting contribution, Saul. We'll be returning to that. Well, anyway, that's enough for us this week. Do join us on Wednesday for the final part of our travelogue, when we're reflecting on it all from the Polish city of Krakow. And then, of course, do come back on Friday when we'll be having another deep dive into the week's news. Goodbye.
I'd like to just add on a personal note that pretty much since we started the Ukraine element of the Battleground podcast, I've been getting daily messages from my mum, Cherry, giving me pointers about news stories and anything relevant to Ukraine. Well, sadly, a couple of days ago, those messages stopped when my mum passed away. She'll be much missed.
Hello, listeners. It's Anita Arnand here from the Goalhanger sister podcast, Empire, which I host along with...
me, William Dalrymple. And we are here to tell you about our new series on the Founding Fathers, the men who made America.
We wanted to look at the men who actually founded the country, who dreamt the dream, who wrote the words upon which a country would be born. What were they like? What made them do what they did? What did they actually believe in? And how did they come to play the role that they did in the American Revolution and the creation of America?
What really interested me about this was the contradictions. I mean, we expect these men to be great figures. We've seen the portraits in the galleries. We know the faces from the banknotes. But they're deeply complex figures. But in that, and in that blend of contradiction and intellectual power and writing genius and curiosity and raw ability, lies the nuance and complexity that allows us to understand them. And the United States is in many ways a reflection of them, their beliefs, their experiences.
These are the men who wrote the Constitution. These are the men who created the federal system. In every way, they are totally fundamental to what American politics looks like today.
It all goes back to this extraordinary group of men.
Yeah, and they have rip-roaring yarns as well, let me tell you. So if you want to know why America is the way it is and who the men were who made it, you can listen by searching Empire wherever you get your podcasts.